The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to John Chinnery, alias the Oak Bloke. So big welcome, John.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, everyone. And thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, not least given what we've all been suffering over the weekend with sort of rockets happening in the Middle East as the US and Israel attacked Iran. Plus, we've had over the last couple of weeks the ongoing concerns about agentic AI and how that can disintermediate all the software and tech services companies. So putting all that together, what's your sort of a outlook for equities over the sort of next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, well, I guess if I start with the sort of here and now of the, you know, I mean, we've been attacked. So yes, the Americans and the Israelis attacked Iran, but Iran has attacked British soil, which is at Akrotiri. So my view on it would be, I would expect our prime minister to retaliate with the full force of our military. But that's my personal view. I'm not here to talk about politics. I'm here to talk about. So look, I think. But my view is that Iran is gonna, you know, things are gonna sort of de-escalate quite quickly. I think in a few weeks this will be blown over, overwhelming force and all the rest of it. So, I mean, look, today, obviously, you know, oil is up quite sharply, precious metals up a bit, And I guess, you know, there's a lot of probably people thinking, ooh, you know, should we be panicking? But I guess, you know, to my own mind of where we are now, buybacks are continuing at quite a number of shares. I mean, certainly in quite a number of my shares. So the buyback cushion just gets bigger and better. You know, stocks are the only product where people get more miserable. The lower they get, the cheaper they get. But, you know, that's a sort of Warren Buffett quote. I would also say that GBP is probably going to weaken versus the dollar. So there's opportunity there. If you've got anything dollar denominated, chances are you're going to be a beneficiary to that. Assuming I'm talking to people in the UK, of course. And I think that, you know, keep calm and carry on. I mean, I think panicking and selling and you know, I think is the wrong move.
Yeah, no, I think it's wise words that. I mean, when I looked at it over the weekend, I was that classic sort of like buy on the sound of cannons, because when there's lots of blood on the street, there's an opportunity to pick up stocks that indiscriminately sold off. And I'm with you. I think this sort of like war will probably may even last less than 12 days because Iran has obviously fired off a whole lot of its missiles, but will be struggling to actually replenish those stocks. And if it had a real sort of like big blockbuster sort of nuclear missile or something like that, that it could actually, it would have already sent it off. So I suspect it's going to be sort of like, you know, it's America and Israel. I mean, they've already controlled the skies. So I'm with you. I think some of the stocks that have been sort of like indiscriminately sold are, are going to be, you know, potential opportunities. But just in terms of yourself, how long have you been sort of investing? Because obviously you're new to this show. You're not new to a lot of the investment community, because I know you've got a big sort of following on Substack. But how long have you been investing? What's your sort of experiences and your returns?
Yeah, my background. Well, look, I mean, I've been investing in the stock market since 20 years, but 20 years ago, I was buying a global fund, you know, sort of finding my way, you know, a little bit. I mean, I actually grew up with my grandfather buying the Telegraph and, you know, sort of writing down the daily shares, and he had sort of this sort of pencil marked, you know, BAE has been at these prices over the last, you know, so he sort of did everything by hand and draw little graphs with. So I sort of grew up with it, but I sort of didn't, and I grew up in and around accountancy as well is part of my background. So, I suppose as with many people, took some hits on stuff in my early days, had to learn some lessons the hard way, and just decided I was going to sort of get better at it, and it's sort of turned into a bit of a hobby for me. And I've launched a Substack 2.5 years ago. That's now at 4,000 subscribers, and last year we raised 12,000 for Emmaus, which is a homeless charity. This year, two different charities that people are supporting. There's Aspire, which is for people with spinal injuries. So every 2 hours in Britain, every 2 hours, someone suffers a life-changing spinal injury. So that's one. And then Trees for Life, which is rewilding the Scottish Highlands. So wildcats, lynxes, red squirrels, you know, we're batting for the little guys.
Brilliant. Okay, well, just to let everybody know, if you lose me, I froze then, unfortunately, and I don't know whether it's because Iran's attacking my internet connection or something like that. I don't normally get it, but I just got sort of froze. But anyway, thanks for carrying on there, John. Now let's talk to some stocks and stuff. I know you've got one international payments company, Wise, a real sort of poster child, an international sort of forex, and I use it, and I know my business uses it, and it's excellent. But can you take us through the investment thesis of why you like Wise?
Yeah, well, look, this is one that I've published research on this morning, so people are going to be like, "Oh, he likes Wise, does he?" So I mean, I've invested in it for a little while, and I did sort of allude to this on an article where I said a global macro and payments, and so a quadrillion, which is a thousand trillion or a million billion. So there's 2 quadrillion of international payments that go through SWIFT every year. And that process is inherently very, very complicated, expensive, and Wise has wised up to a way of doing it more deeply, to the point where no one can compete with what Wise is doing. So it's fascinating. I mean, they now have, as well as your business, Paul, 0.47% of the B2B and B2C international payments market. So they've got, you know, to dominate that, they could grow 200 times. But then the wholesale market and the SWIFT payments, they have 0.01% of that. I mean, 0.01% of the 2 quadrillion. So the growth on this is just incredible, and the value. I mean, yes, you're paying eight and a bit billion to buy Wise. I mean, you're not buying this because it's at a discount to its NAV or whatever. But it's just that nobody can compete. I mean, they're making 16% operating margin. What they're actually doing is aggressively moving their take rate downwards so that no one can actually touch them. I mean, competitors can't touch them. I've gone through and looked at Revolut and what they're doing around stable coins. Can't touch them. Cannot compete with Wise and the pricing of Wise. And I think that as that grows and dominates, I mean, the value there, I mean, I kind of looked at it and said, well, if you take it down to 0.35% take rate, so from where it is today, 0.54, and assume 10%, which obviously is a lot larger than it is today, but 10% market share, because who else is going to have the 90%, you know, but let's say 10%. I mean, then you're looking at a 22 billion valuation, which is 1.5 times higher than it is today. So that's, I mean, it's not one that's going to necessarily be for tomorrow, that it's, you know, suddenly going to re-rate tomorrow. But for my, you know, this is an investment over a couple of years that I think this will come good. And I think equally it could just get taken out by somebody at some point, and it won't be at 8 billion.
Yeah, no, it's a great company. And I think they're trying to list, aren't they, out in the States, aren't they, on NASDAQ, yes, later on in the year, which should hopefully sort of get in gen, sort of encourage a few investors over there to put some money into. But I guess we had one of its not competitors, but a big sort of dog in this market. We had Block last week, Jack Dorsey's, announcing that it was going to remove or shed 40% of its staff. Is this going to be a similar sort of story that effectively could be a beneficiary of AI, because it can actually utilize a lot of the software that is actually, and the sort of white collar expertise of generative AI, and replace a lot of its cost?
It's a great question. I mean, look, I mean, Block, I have looked at in a while, but I'm aware that Block has had some challenges, and you know, some of that sort of, oh, we're going to cut back our people because we're going to do it all via agentic AI. Yeah, maybe that's partly a cover story. I don't exactly know whether that's the case, but I would say the point about agentic AI is that agentic AI is going to use APIs, and APIs are application program interfaces. Wise has got an AI that the wholesale market are using. I mean, Morgan Stanley are using, Standard Chartered are using, and other banks as well. So if anything, I mean, Wise will actually, I mean, if agentic AI takes off in the way that we kind of imagine it could or will or shall, it's going to be a huge beneficiary to that. And that percentage of share is going to grow because it can tap into that agentic AI macro.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great great stock for people to have a look at. I mean, as I say, anecdotal evidence. I know you shouldn't buy a stock based on whether you use the actual software or use the service, but as a person who's a customer of it, it is absolutely fab, and it's head and shoulders above any of the others. So and I use it for, say, both my business and my personal travel.
I'm a great believer in, like, if you own something that you know that works, I think that's not a bad thing.
No, scuttlebutt research is definitely one. Okay, let's move to the oil and gas sector now. Surprise, surprise, most of these stocks have gone up this morning since Brent is up 8%. Let's move to diversified energy. We don't hardly ever cover this one, actually. I think it's a sort of like an explorer of, say, oil and gas out in the States. The shares rose a lot at the start of the Ukraine-Russia war as the oil price shot up. It's come down like most of the other oil and gas stocks and then just perked up. What sort of, like, specifically attracted you to this oil and gas O&E provider?
Yeah, great question. I mean, the background to this one, if you go back far enough, this is a little company that listed on AIM back when, you know, a lot of companies were listing on AIM, and it was because the US basically weren't interested in they were too small. The guy, Rusty, set up his bought his first oil well 25 years ago, basically bought a package. I think he listed it at something like 40 million back on AIM. I mean, from 40 million, humble beginnings, obviously 40 million is not that humble, but it's now a much, much larger. So it's grown an awful lot. Until quite recently, explorer, it hasn't actually done any exploring. It's actually more of a consolidator. So there's two types of, in simple terms, there's two types of oil well drilling. There's vertical wells and horizontal wells. And horizontal wells, you might know, is fracked wells. So the great thing, I mean, the way I look at these is it's like tortoises and hares, okay? So if you drill horizontally, and obviously it's a great innovation and progress that fracking was invented, you get prodigious even amounts of oil and gas very quickly, very high flow rates. So like a hare, it will bound ahead and the poor old tortoise is left, and nobody wants the tortoises except DEC, DEC. So DEC has been hoovering up the vertical wells from its competitors. And people sort of say, that's a real negative. They're buying the stuff nobody wants and that there's going to be huge costs of retiring these wells. And there is a cost to retiring the wells, obviously a lot less of a cost if you own a company that retires wells, which they do. They've expanded that to 25 rigs. But the problem with the hares, yes, they've got prodigious rates of flow, but after a couple of years, the hare is ready to go to sleep. And the tortoise, meanwhile, has got decades of plodding along, producing gas and oil. And that's where DEC is just fantastic, is that it's, if you look at it from an NPV, net present value, discounted at 10%, and it gets lost in that discounting is that because you're talking about decades and decades and decades, 80 years of discounted at 10%, the stuff that's like 30, 40, 50, 60 plus years away is like worth nothing, but it's going to be worth something in those years to come. So that, I think with DEC, it's just played blinder after blinder after blinder. Recently buying up $250 million little tuck-in deal, as they call them, called Sheridan. That they're buying an NPV discounted to zero at 15%, which actually, again, if you do the maths, I mean, it's, you know, they're basically just, you know, last year they bought Maverick, and on top of like all the land sales and the price they paid for it, I mean, they've made about $1 billion in terms of net present value on that acquisition. I mean, it's just, it gets misunderstood, you see, Paul, because of IFRS 9. Yeah. So
I did see there was actually, you know, a couple of bearish comments on it in terms of those sort of long term liabilities for plugging the actual wells. It's said somewhere it's got 70,000 wells. Correct. To actually plug, and the arithmetic that its provisions it's put on is about, it's under $25,000 to plug a well, whereas the industry standards apparently is about $75,000 to $100,000 to a well. How do you rationalize that? Is that because it's easier on the vertical to plug it rather than the horizontal or something? I don't know.
Well, it's a couple of things, really. Number one, I mean, it's 75. Well, it's more expensive to plug horizontal wells. That's the first thing to say. So, yes, they do have some horizontal wells, but majority are vertical wells. So fracked wells are more expensive to deal with. Second thing, I mean, those sort of quoted prices as if you went out and got a third party to do it. If you own the drill equipment, and basically the way that you plug a well is the same way as that you drill a well. You know, you use a rig and it goes down and basically pull out all the casing, fill in cement and plug it, and, you know, put grass over and make it all nice again. You know, that's the sort of gist of it. So owning their own equipment, selling their services to third parties, because the thing is, yes, I mean, they own 71,000 wells, but there's 2 million wells in the US, and a lot of those are what's called orphaned wells, or they're, you know, they're owned by, like Rusty was 25 years ago, they're owned by private companies that, you know, may sort of, you know, they there's a lot of and when you look at the average revenue they get for plugging third party wells, they're earning about between 120,000 and 150,000 through orphaned well programs. So their 25,000, the rationalization of that is, well, the true cost is probably about, I mean, I've worked it out at about 40, 45, but there's about a 20,000 offset from the profit of doing other people's wells. And that's how they do it.
Right. Okay, fantastic. All right. Okay, well, let's move on. We've got a pre-question. We have Nick. He's asking about MPAC, sort of like a fast, that ultra fast packaging machines and factory automation company that was doing really, really well in sort of like 2023 and 2024, having acquired a couple of companies, and then got hit by the tariffs. So there was a slowdown in capital expenditure in factories, but the position now seems to have stabilized. What sort of piqued your interest here?
One big beautiful bill. I'm not going to do a Trump accent or impersonation, because that would just be a bit embarrassing for everyone. Look, I mean, 100% expensing of the stuff that MPAC sells kind of makes it a no-brainer. Now, I mean, has the US deal flow suddenly shot up in 2026? No, it doesn't look like it. I mean, it looks like, you know, certainly the second half 25 results were steady. But there was a couple of, I mean, I've put some research out this morning on this. There's a couple of things that I pulled out, which I thought, actually, that's very positive. 25% increase on original equipment orders in the second half, on the basis that you sell your original equipment order and then later on you sell services, like the follow-on services. So the fact that the share or the proportion of the OE has increased by 25%, I took to be a big positive. The increase to operating profit, again, you know, that is actually has gone from 3.5 to 7.5. Overall, they made 11. They went from 7.5 to 11 million operating profit in the second half of 25. And that's sort of my estimate, because we only have the trading update, but they've said it's in line. And also that the intake of orders grew as well. I mean, it's sort of, you know, steady as well. So look, I mean, you know, after service revenue in high 60s EBITDA margin, original equipment low 40s EBITDA margin. There's a lot to like about it, and I think their strategic acquisition of CSI it kind of gave them the bit in the middle, because they were selling the bit at the end, the bit at the start, and then they sort of had to go to somebody else to get the bit in the middle. Whereas now they're offering an end-to-end packaging solution to a wide variety of businesses, and I think that it's got a lot further to run. And as I say, with the one big beautiful bill, that's one massive macro that, I mean, even if it's not going to be sort of now in spring 26, it's going to happen because of the deglobalization is a massive macro that I'm investing into.
Yeah, no, I think it's another smart sort of like idea, because with smart manufacturing coming in, and if you believe the story about AI or agentic AI powering robotics, then essentially we've already seen warehouses which are now dark. They don't have people. They just have engineers servicing the robots. Well, it isn't going to be a stretch of the imagination to have basically hardly anybody in these fully automated factories, the production lines. And if you're going to have robots in there, essentially doing some of the ex-manual stuff, you're going to need effectively machines and automation for your production and your packaging line. So it could accelerate that whole adoption of smart manufacturing and automation. So, I think you're right. And I was looked at the multiples, and I think Mpac traded just over 7x EBITDA. Yeah. And its biggest one of its competitors in the States is 12x. So it's cheap. Yeah.
Well, and you know, you look at some of the other robotics companies, they're on much higher multiples. One of my ideas last year was BOTG, which is an ETF, and I would say the average multiple on that was, you know, at or above 20. You know, like Fanuc, which is one of its customers, that is something like 28x, I think.
Yeah. Okay, good one. I know you've got real expertise also in emerging markets. Let's go to Echo Buildings. These guys do prefab, sort of like residential houses. I think they've got a manufacturing facility in Albania, but they sort of like now service countries who need cheap and quick sort of accommodation for their population, places in Africa and places. And they won that massive, didn't they, that deal out in Chile. Do you want to take us through this one, why you've chosen Echo Buildings?
Yeah. Well, look, I kind of came across this, and it's a technology play as much as anything else, but also just the simple fact that it costs an awful lot of money to build houses. You know, the origin of what these guys build or produce is glass fiber reinforced gypsum, or GFRG. And this stuff has been around since, or buildings have been around made of this stuff since the 1970s. And you can go to Australia and see GFRG buildings, and they're fine. You know, they look good as new type thing, and they're 50 years old. So this technology is essentially, I'm going to make a 36 square meter panel out of this GFRG. Compare it to bricks. I know bricks and brickability and things like that are things that you've looked at in your past. I mean, a GFRG wall, to have the same level of stability or you know, building codes, building standards, only needs to be about half the thickness. The way that it works is that you create these cast iron. So they've got this machine that will make 36 square meter panels. Those panels then get dried. The panels have four hollow segments inside, so you can run water pipes, electrical pipes. The way it works is because of that thinner aspect to it, essentially they get filled with cement is where some of that structural integrity comes in. But they're, I mean, Chile, I don't know if you know about Chile, but Chile has one of, well, the worst earthquake that ever happened that we know about happened in Chile in 1960. I think it was 9 on the Richter scale. So a big deal for Chile is like, will your building stay up when an earthquake happens? Now, one of the one of the features of GFRG is what's called ductibility, and I had to look this up. But ductibility is essentially stretchiness. So when you know an earthquake happens, will your building? And of course, if you made it out of cement, then the cement would shatter. But because this GFRG is essentially like a sort of stretchiness, but it has the cement inside its core, it's a bit like the same principle as steel reinforced concrete. You know that you kind of put the steel, it provides the bendiness, and then the concrete. So it's the same sort of concept. They also add silicon to make it waterproof, and glass fiber is horrible, stinky stuff. But I say that from having been to some glass fiber factories. But yeah, look, I mean, it's a cheaper building material than brick. They make about 40% margin, about 5 times faster to construct. Far less CO2. Basically, use CNC machines to cut out the windows and doors. So you'd have like a building design. You know, I want my windows like this, doors like that. They just build it all out. They crane it onto a truck, they drive it. I mean, they've got orders in Albania. They're building out a thing of villas there. They've got partnerships in Sudan, Senegal. And there's one other country as well, which is, let me just look at my notes, Indonesia. Sorry, that's the new one that and there's prospective deals that are, I mean, you can just imagine like a housing association in the UK saying, look, you know, let's kind of get involved with these guys. And build cost is reduced, labor cost is reduced, there's no finishing needed, no plastering needed. There's so many aspects to it. I mean, this is a 20 million market cap. It has gone up. It's up 300% since I wrote about it last September. But I mean, even at 20 million now, I know there have been some criticisms of, well, show me the contract, because they're actually a 100%. They are sort of 100%. They're not doing a joint venture in Chile, but they've got prospectively this £420 million contract. Is there any evidence to that? Has the Chilean government officially sort of said, oh yes, you know, eco buildings? No, they haven't. But I just come back to, well, what else are the Chilean government going to do? Because they need houses. I mean, everywhere needs houses. Britain needs houses. 1.5 million, we were told, in this current 5 years of government. I think it's if it achieves even a fraction of what it is currently worked on, and when you consider there's 3 joint ventures where the joint venture partners are all throwing in about $5 million into that partnership, which is going to basically afford the capital equipment to replicate the GFRG machine and start production. I mean, you get to 20 million just through that and the assets in Albania. So yeah, it feels mispriced.
Yeah. No, I could understand, obviously, in emerging markets being really, because I mean, obviously, they can't afford the bricks, and it's much cheaper and it's much quicker and all this. I mean, and obviously, the ductibility is good, but what's about the durability? Because that's the problem with prefab houses in the UK anyway, is that after 20 years, they look absolutely, you know, they've been kicked in and they've been graffitiized and they look terrible.
Well, look, I remember fondly the little TARDIS, the prefabs that came up after the war, and you know, they were in my local area. They're all gone now, unfortunately. Yeah. It's sad, but yeah, no, totally get that. I mean, all I can say is that when you look at the durability of the buildings in Australia that are, you know, now over 50 years old, I would say the problem with other prefab materials like wood and you know, the stuff, like, because a lot of German houses, I think, or a lot of the Germans sort of make things prefabricated. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the shelf life on that is quite limited. Whereas GFRG, I mean, basically gypsum is like a type of rock. Glass fiber, as you know, is, I mean, there are glass fiber, you know, that's commonly used for sort of like the post office and the telecoms, or, you know, sort of street furniture. So it's, you know, they are hard wearing materials. And I think I would say as well, I mean, it's an important point. It's got CE accreditation. So CE is the Conformité Européenne. And I mean, like, it's basically got, you know, official building code sign off in Chile, in the UK, in the EU. They're heading towards getting it in Canada. I couldn't speak for the building codes in Sudan and Senegal and Indonesia, but I mean, they're gonna, obviously Indonesia is another earthquake ridden country, isn't it? Yeah. Krakatoa was there in 1886.
Yeah. What about the sort of like, in terms of, because obviously we're getting climate change and stuff. When it gets hot, if you've got sort of like, you know, thin walls, et cetera, it gets absolutely boiling inside, while the brick sort of insulates it. And then likewise in the winter, if you've got a cold area, it, you know, thin walls mean what you're heating.
No, funnily enough, I looked at this because I was interested in whether that was the case. And especially, like, I thought, why the heck are the Canadians looking at eco buildings? Now, it's interesting that brick is more insulating than GFRG when it's dry. And of course, you know, in the UK and in Canada, obviously, you know, places that are not, you know, they get plenty of snow and rain. Actually, GFRG is a better insulating material because the insulation when wet is actually superior.
Okay.
And there's a study that I read on ResearchGate about that. So that's how sad I am.
Yeah, okay, well done. Good. Okay, we've got a question from John or Johnny Johnson. He's asking about PureTech, which I think you may own, or you know, it's basically a biotech innovator, I think, that develops compounds and potential candidates for further drug development, but it's pre-clinical trial, and then it allows the big boys, the sort of like large biotechs and the biopharma companies, then do the further developments. It's done really well with Bristol Myers, a stock that I own as well, because it's got a drug there, Cobenfarm. Farm. Anyway, do you want to take us through what you think about this one?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, obviously the Cobenfarm deal was fantastic. And, you know, they got, I mean, this is a drug that they started off with owning 100% of, and, you know, they diluted themselves down over, you know, phase one, phase two, phase three trials, and in the end owned about 2.3% of it. But even that was worth, I think it was about $300 million or $350 million they sold it for. So they did a buyback and did a tender offer for PureTech in investors back then. But I mean, fast forward to today. I mean, there's a couple of things I would say about Cobenfy to start with, the schizophrenia drug. There's enormous amounts of complexity about introducing new drugs with a complex disease like schizophrenia, and people with schizophrenia also commonly have other conditions. So, for example, Alzheimer's and schizophrenia is a common combination. I didn't really know anything about this until I looked at PureTech. So there's a couple of milestones that PureTech have got that BMS will potentially be paying a further $400 million to PureTech based upon sales performance, based upon the applicability of Cobenfy for schizophrenia for Alzheimer's, for example. And I mean, there's a couple of things I'd say is that, I mean, you could buy PureTech today for £290 million. So it's got about £300 million of net current assets. So take away all the current liabilities, take away from the current assets, and you're left with $300 million. So that's about 225 million quid. So take the difference from one to the other, and you're left with, you know, you're paying about 60 something million quid for PureTech. So it's very cheap. Now these guys, if they get their milestone payments, I mean, there's your 60 million to start with. I mean, potentially 300 coming from BMS. But if BMS, if this is the success that it's anticipated to be. Now, the progress has been slow and slower than I think, well, it's met internal sales target plans is what Bristol Myers have actually said. So, you know, there are some that are saying, oh, well, its rollout is slow. Well, not according to BMS. They're saying the rollout is as anticipated. I read in, I think it was Psychologists Today. It was one of the psychology magazines or publications, research public, you know, and basically the feedback in that was very, very positive. There was another one that gave the contra view, which was, well, the problem is that it's not as easy as that, and what about side effects, what about this, what about that. So, you know, obviously a lot of sort of counterpoints, but if they get above 2 billion in sales, I mean, there's a further tickle of 2%, but sorry, I probably have to speed up here because I'm conscious of our time is limited. But I mean, when you consider the pipeline of what these guys have got, I mean, last week or maybe the week before, they got orphan designation for their Celia, which is the LYT-100, which is for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is a $10 billion dollar market, $10 billion opportunity. Now, orphan designation means 10 years exclusivity in the EU, 7 years exclusivity in the USA. The share price of PureTech didn't budge a penny. and I mean, the fact that these guys have now got sort of in the two largest territories, you know, the largest drug markets, the EU and the US, that they've got exclusivity for something that's at phase three. So it's not certain, there's a risk, but they're at phase three. It's seen as well tolerated. It's something called deupirfenidone. So there is an existing drug out in the market called pirfenidone. And people, I mean, this is already a safe drug, and you know, it's already signed off. People can be prescribed it. The problem is it has side effects. And this is the bit where I said it's well tolerated. Well, well tolerated is the problem with the existing one. So deupirfenidone is kind of, but the other sort of quick thing I'd say around PureTech is their technology, the Glyph technology. So you'll know that your liver is there to sort of protect you from poisoning and toxicity. Well, the problem with taking drugs is that your liver will straight away try and intercept those drugs and destroy them. And that's where you get sort of what's called hepatotoxicity, which is basically toxicity of your liver. Well, the way Glyph works is that they go in through your lymph glands. So it sidesteps the liver. So it's a new way of delivering drugs that has, I mean, that alone is, I think, worth a vast amount of money one day, but they need to prove it, and so that there's a couple of other drugs that are earlier stage but that will potentially do that. They also own 35% of Seaport, which is working on a generalized anxiety disorder, and that's at phase two. So yeah, look, I mean, PureTech, as far as I'm concerned, is massively mispriced.
So what would be, I mean, if 300 million market cap, what's just the sum of the parts on it when you put all that together? I mean, risk adjusted sort of stuff. Just, I mean, are we talking two times, three times? I mean,
I mean, at least, yes. I mean, look, I mean, even if, only Coben fire is successful, it's worth double or more. And then, I mean, if they can get Celia, if the phase three comes through positively, and there is probably about a 12-month wait on that, but there'll be interim results this year, and that will kind of give a strong indication. So yeah, I mean, I'd say the upside is several hundred, you know, potentially several. I mean, there's no certainties to these things. I'd also say that generally biotechs, I mean, I own RTW Pharmaceutical, and I mean, I don't own Biog, but I'm aware that everything else is up about 50%. PureTech's down 12%. It's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I know, because I mean, I own Bristol Myers Squibb, and I think they've identified Coben fire, sort of like $5 billion sale, peak sale type of drug. And if he gets that, it will trigger all your milestones. It will make Bristol Myers a shed load of money, and obviously PureTech. And what's quite interesting, you've spotted, is you've got an arbitrage opportunity, because that upside is in the Bristol Myers share price, but not in the that upside in the PureTech. So it's a good arbitrage. Well spotted that. Okay, let's move to something which has been spotted. I mean, you probably spotted some time ago. Is Thor Explorations, gold miner in Africa, I think, Nigeria and Senegal. Surprise, surprise, the shares have been like a rocket ship. What's your latest on this one, and whether do you hold your top slice? Because, I mean, it is just a one-way trip. It's been brilliant for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to brag too much, but yeah, I mean, I bought it down when it was sort of there on the left hand side at that price, and it it's made a lot of money, which is great. And yeah, look, I would say with Thor that did I top slice? Yes. When it dropped back, did I buy more? Now, buying more is always tough because you're kind of looking at your, you know, oh, I've made 700%, you know, and I was buying it at 10p and it's now, I think today it's 87, 88p. So, you know, I've averaged up to about 45p now. And that's hard because psychologically you think, oh, now I'm not seeing 700% or 750. I'm only seeing 100%, you know, and like you've got to sort of get over that because, I mean, I was sort of saying it in one of my articles, you've got to sort of just look at the pounds and the pence, you know, and that's kind of one of the things that I've been doing. But look, I've been buying more of Thor. That rhymes, doesn't it? I've been buying more of Thor because, I mean, the Segi Lola alone, I mean, just quick background to these guys. The thing that attracted to me them in the first place was that they had a deal where they were going to get like no income tax until the end of 2027. And then after 2027, they'd be able to offset accrued expenditure against future tax. So essentially they've got, I mean, the way it works is the EBITDA, like more of it, I mean, there is some depreciation, amortization, but essentially the EBITDA just drops straight down to the net profit. And like, how often do you get that in a stock? I mean, it's incredible. And the EBITDA, or the, you know, in gold mining terms, they call it the AISC, the all-in sustaining cost, which is approximately the same. It's kind of doesn't include one-offs or sort of non-sustaining capital, but doesn't include growth capital. But yeah, in principle, I mean, the ASIC on this is or was below $1,000, and when gold is at what, 5,400 today, I mean, you are making like 4,400 an ounce. You know, you're making something that's costing you $1,000. You're paying nothing else, pretty much nothing else on it. Now, their ASIC has or is forecast to go up to about 1,200 or between 1,000 and 1,200 in 2026 because Segi Lola is getting mined out and they're doing drilling and they're extending it, talking about potentially going underground. But the other part to this is that they've got second and third mines. Now, earlier stage, the one in they've got one called Douta, which is in Senegal. The PFS on that, and this is sort of where you're taking a 5% net present value, you know, that's at 73% internal rate of return, and that's at $3,500 per ounce of gold. And at that level, it was an 11-month payback. Now, my calculations is that the NPV is more like $2 billion. Now, I mean, yes, this is still, you know, this has gone up a lot, but it's still just a fraction of what it's worth. And then it's third, which is Ivory Coast. I mean, again, earlier stage, again, it's sort of geochemical stage and they haven't done a lot of drilling. But the geochemical, I mean, they're finding results of very, very nice levels of 10 grams per ton and things like that. And I mean, you are going to, like, 1 gram per ton or more, generally you're going to make money, especially if it's shallow. You know, if you have to go hundreds of meters to get 1 gram of gold, forget it. Like if it's at surface, 1 gram of gold, great, we'll make some money. 2 grams of gold, yeah, we're going to make even more money. You know, when you're getting 10 grams of gold, you know, that is very, very good. And then the other part to this story is the lithium. Now, Nigeria, everyone knows it for oil and gas, and, you know, there's a lot of oil there, which is true. And this is why they got this tax-free deal with the Nigerian government, was that the Nigerian government was like, bit like Saudi Arabia. You know, we want to diversify. We want to sort of, you know, sort of set up a mining industry, something other than oil and gas. That's why they offered the tax-free deal. They've also got some Chinese companies developing and, you know, sort of producing battery products, lithium-based battery products. So there is lithium in Nigeria, and Thor own, again, some prospective areas which contain good levels of lithium. So there's another part to the story, and that might be another tax deal, possibly. Don't know that for
sure. How sustainable is the gold price at just over $5,000 per ounce? I know this one is the sort of like $64 million question, because it has gone up sort of like quadrupled over the last 2 or 3 years. And one thing about commodities is high prices are the best solution for high prices.
Yeah. Yes. Well, look, absolutely. No, it's a good question to be asking. I mean, my thesis, a couple of things. I mean, number one, I don't sort of go around sort of quoting everything on 5,500 gold. I sort of tend to, you know, sort of assume that things are going to pull back. And I think on Thor, I wrote about Thor about a month ago, and that was at, I think I used 4,500 as the peg level. So yeah, I think there's, it's always good to be conservative on these things. But no, look, I mean, the bit that I tell you, in fact, one thing that happened that kind of made me sort of think, well, gold isn't going to really go anywhere, was that when the EU and the UK tried to expropriate Russian assets, and it was, I think it was 300 billion of assets that were owned by the Russians that were in Belgium, and they basically said, right, you know, we're going to sort of grab them and use them to pay for the Ukraine war. It was at that point that the BRICS nations clubbed together and said, we're going to create an alternative to the dollar called the unit. That unit is 25% backed by gold. So we've like the BRICS nations have kind of gone back to the gold standard. I mean, when you look at central bank buying of gold, it's colossal. When you look at private investors' ownership of gold, it is well below the long-term average, well below. I mean, it's 1.6. And I think if you go back in time, that levels of gold ownership, or, you know, as part of a portfolio, I mean, there are people now sort of saying, rather than doing the 60-40, it should be like 60-20-20, and the 20 is made partly up of gold. And I think even if people had 2% of their portfolio in gold as a hedge, I don't think gold's going to go down, certainly not meteorically down, because there's just so much support for it.
Yeah, and I know the stable coins out in the States have been buying, haven't they? Tether's got about $5 or $10 billion worth of, rather than buying US dollars, it's been buying gold because it thinks it's got a stronger backing, which is probably true. Okay, let's switch sectors. Let's go to aircraft leasing. We've got Avation in the UK. Shares are down slightly today, which is not a surprise given the geopolitical concerns about airlines and aircraft. Anyway, what's a thesis on this one?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you know, even this morning they've announced that they're going to sort of add 5 more aircraft to pre-delivery. So they've got purchase delivery rights. Now, this is a really strange setup, because normally you wouldn't book a profit until you've made a profit, right? But these guys, for whatever reason, do and have. So on their balance sheet, they've got, I think it's about $85 million of assets that are made up of purchase delivery rights. And this is the right to buy an ATR 72-600 aircraft at a discount. So, and these are sort of turboprop aircraft that do short hop, you know, short haul flights. Consume about half the energy, half the fuel of jet planes. So, you know, if you want to travel cheaply, an ATR is the way to do it. And these are very much in demand in Asia. So anywhere where you've got sort of islands, I mean, that's ideal. But also where you've got mountains, I mean, they're obviously short runway, capable of running on sustainable aviation fuel. So lots and lots of, there's a really positive macro where basic people are flying more. I mean, if you saw that program Race Around the World, and the the British, there was like four teams, and they were all kind of going in coaches, and where you have the luggage bay, that was where the luxury travel was. You know, you had these little compartments. Well, that's the way people travel in India today, or you know, a lot of people. Yeah. But when you actually look at their airport building program, I mean, they're building out hundreds of airports. The Chinese have just done the same as well. So the flight macro, I mean, they reckon that in the next couple of years, that hundreds and hundreds of millions of Indians that have, you know, would take a coach to go on pilgrimage or whatever, the sort of Hindu shrines, that they're going to be flying there instead. So there's a massive macro behind this. It's also the case that when you look at the last set of accounts that you could have, when you see the pre-delivered aircraft that is already on the balance sheet, you look at was that then sort of a gain or a loss? In other words, did they make more money on top of what they've already put onto their balance sheet? Well, the answer was they made 1.5 million. So if you take 1.5 million times the 33 advanced purchase rights, that gets you plus 50 million. I mean, this is already on a discount of 48%. Then you sort of say, well, what's the going rate of its current fleet of aircraft? Because it owns 33, it owns an Airbus 330, a couple of 220s, a 221, and then a load of ATRs. Well, the answer back from ATR was that, according to an aviation expert, the book value understates it by about 83 million. So add all of that together. I mean, you're buying AVAP at a 67% discount to its NAV. And the other thing I'd quickly say is that they sold off their star player. And the star player was a Boeing 777. Sold that off. That was the one that made them the most money. The real results came in. Their revenue was down 0.2 million, even though star player was sold off in August. So, you know, for 4 months or over 4 months of the second half, the 6 month period, they basically didn't set, you know, their lease revenue was only 0.2 million lower than the first half. And that just reflects that the lease rates are going up. You know, that the fact that they've put in a little guy to replace the big guy kind of hasn't mattered. So the lease rates are the other reason that I'm very positive about this.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly get the ATRs in places like Africa in particular. Short runways and low fuel usage is ideal. I mean, jets just don't apply. They can't land at most airports in Africa. You have to have basically a turboprop. I guess that the other side of the coin is that your customers, who you say your regional airlines in Africa, what are their sort of like, is the credit quality like? Because obviously this all depends on whether your customers can pay for those aircraft. Yeah. How do they deal with that? Because obviously you get a number of airlines in Europe going bust, you know, low cost ones, but how do you see that in terms of Africa and the Asia?
Well, look, I mean, they've got 18 different customers. I mean, basically their customers are the airlines, exactly to your point. I mean, in the last results, they had Brathens, as you know, they went bust. So they've got back two of their ATRs. I mean, look, the view back from management was that they're going to release those aircraft. They're going to sort of see, lease them to new. There's such a queue of people. I mean, what you've got to realize as well is that the average age of an ATR aircraft, a turboprop aircraft, I mean, there's literally hundreds and hundreds, if not low thousands, that are overdue for replacement. So there's basically a big queue for the door. And you'll probably know that, you know, Boeing have a few issues with getting their aircraft out on time and on spec and so there's, I mean, basically there's a real shortage of aircraft, and that's a real positive. So Avation, I mean, is just mispriced as far as I'm concerned.
Good. Okay, well, let's move to another part of Africa. Let's go to Integrated Diagnostic Holdings, which is a diagnostics business in the Middle East. I think it's headquartered in Egypt, but services sort of Jordan and Nigeria and Sudan and places. The shares have done very, very well. What sort of like, again, interest sort of like excited you about sort of going into this one? Because we hardly ever cover it at all, because obviously the geopolitical risk, but I suppose, you know, sort of aging populations and growing populations for diagnostics and healthcare services. But anyway, what do you see it?
Well, look, yeah, I mean, you know, the Egyptian, I mean, there's 110 million Egyptians, Nigerians, I think it's 240 million. And, you know, so you've got sort of something like a 400 and something million target market, and there's penetration, very low percentage penetration into all of those markets. In other words, there's years and years of growth ahead, and all of the economies in which they operate, they are sort of growing fast. They're 4%, 5% GDP growth. And I think it's true to say, I mean, according to World Bank, that as GDP increases, spend on healthcare disproportionately increases. So that's a big part of the macro. I'd also say that the Egyptian economy particularly has gone through some tough times. I mean, it basically went through a period of hyperinflation and devaluation. A lot of that is behind it now. It's a bit like, I mean, Britain went to the IMF in the 1970s. I mean, the Egyptians went to the IMF in the 2020s. But that tough medicine's working. So just as you saw in the 1980s in Britain, you know, a real expansion and growth and revival. I mean, there's talk now of Egypt being the tiger economy of the 2020s, that it could grow at 8% a year. And it's a couple of simple things. I mean, when you look at the net profit, and this is in GBP terms, not in Egyptian pounds, but you could do it in Egyptian pounds and the numbers would be even more impressive. But in GBP terms, if you took the net profit per patient in 2021 versus 2025, that has grown in GBP terms, despite the devaluation, from £1.74 to £2.26. The net profits on a constant currency basis in 2025 grew 107%. I mean, the performance is just absolutely spectacular. And I think the other thing I'd quickly add is the mega lab. I only recently sort of realized the scale of this, that it's... I mean, yes, there are larger facilities in the US, in I think Richmond. Yeah, there's one that can process 60,000 tests per hour, but the mega lab has processing speeds of 30,000 per hour, and there's just nothing like it in Africa. There's nothing like it, even nothing like it in the Middle East. The best of the rest in the Middle East are at about 20,000 per hour. So, like, you're talking Abu Dhabi, you know, Bahrain, like all of them. Like it's kind of European grade. I mean, there's a couple in Europe that are at 40,000, so slightly ahead, you know, but I mean, it's a world-class facility, and the cost of sale of that just means that this is in my opinion, a real winner.
Yeah, just in terms of their, I mean, I see they pay a dividend, about 3.5% yield, etc. How do they do that? How do they get the money out of Egypt? And I mean, Egypt's notoriously tough to get money out without withholding taxes.
Yeah, it used to be. I mean, look, the withholding tax is 10%, so that you need to factor that in. It's less than the Americans charge at 15%, but I mean, they do charge something. It's 10 business days to get money out of Egypt to the UK, but IDHC have a shortcut because they've got operations in Saudi Arabia, and there's basically a link through between the two systems that mean that they can move money from Egypt to Saudi Arabia between one business day and three business days, and then from Saudi Arabia to the UK it's instantaneous. So yeah, I mean, it used to be a problem, I'd agree, but now it's really not. It's and as I say, I mean, with the IMF, there's a huge privatization program going on in Egypt, and the expansion, actually, I mean, there's a lot of expansion into the KSA, Saudi Arabia, some into Nigeria, and I think yeah, as I say, I mean, the double-digit growth, I mean, there's years of potential ahead of it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, you say you've done really well out of these frontier and emerging markets. I mean, you know, I tend to not to go at that place, but you've made a shed load of money. Another one you've done very well on is ASA International, which is a micro finance or financer for entrepreneurs and little businesses across, I think it's Africa and Asia. Certainly a company you wouldn't have thought would have done well in the stock price, but wow, when you look at the shares, I mean, over the last year, it's tripled. So what's been driving that growth?
And they're paying a dividend as well. So look, I mean, big thing I'd say there is that I mean, ROTE, which is return on tangible equity, is what you would measure a bank by generally. And a lot of the British banks, I mean, you'd get, what, 13 to 15% ROTE from NatWest, HSBC, and all, NatWest and HSBC, I mean, all have been doing very, very well as well. So I think banking has been a good sector. I mean, apart from Bank of Georgia, which is owned by Capital Georgia, which is, you know, another idea from 2024 for me, the only company I found that had a higher ROTE than Bank of Georgia, Lion Bank, as I think they're now called, is ASAI. These guys have got had a 38.5% ROTE, return on tangible equity, which is just off the scale. I mean, but at the same time, I mean, 98% of their customers, because essentially they're doing business to business lending. It's, you know, somebody that, I don't know, sells mangoes or sells bananas and, you know, like whatever, you know, they're sort of all buying secondhand clothes and selling them again or whatever, you know, like they're all just business, like generally businesses. 98% of those businesses have profited or grown as a result of the loan. So, you know, these people are taking loans, these business owners are taking loans. They are paying a lot, you know, for those loans, but nobody else will lend them money. You know, the domestic banks are not interested. There's almost a kind of like a club type approach to this. So the bad debts on ASAI are just very, very low. I mean, there was a bad period during COVID, you know, four or five years ago, post-COVID. But a lot of that, again, is in the rearview mirror. I mean, they have a measure that they call PAR, P-A-R, which is basically like 30 days overdue or more. You know, it's sort of, you know, you're sort of in the second bucket of the aged debtors. And even that percentage is like 1.5 to 2%. I mean, it's extremely low. And then the bad debt is in the low millions. So, yeah, I mean, again, just growing fast. The growth, I mean, when you think about it, like Ghana, gold, a lot of gold comes out of Ghana. So the Ghanaian economy is absolutely flying. Mm. The Pakistan economy is absolutely flying. Part of the thesis here as well is that the old way of doing it is everyone would have their little book. And I can remember sort of as a child, National Savings, I had my little National Savings investment book and I, you know, everything was done on paper. Basically what ASAI are doing is introducing digitization. So they've got a banking app called Temenos, which is British. So, I mean, basically they're digitizing the whole thing. The digitization means that they can automate a whole load of stuff. So when you actually superimpose that over what's going on, and these loans are sort of like $200, $240 average. So it's like small beer, like small amounts, but if you can automate some of that, fantastic, you know.
I mean, looking at the net interest margins, it's 39%. I mean, that's absolutely off the charts. Yeah. But which obviously, you say, you've got to watch the credit risk, no doubt. But in terms of the other side of the coin, how does it get its money? Does it take deposits or does it get wholesale funding from the banks? Because that's the other downside, is when the economy starts, if you're relying on another bank to give you cash to lend out, then they suddenly decide, sorry, we're not doing this anymore.
So it does vary by country. I mean, the way they did it in India was that they borrowed from loan holders and that actually hasn't worked terribly well. So some of it is just their own shareholders' equity is used as the loan book. Some of it is just down to savings. And this is actually a big part of Temenos, is that I can offer people more products. I mean, they're cross-selling insurance as well, so like critical illness cover and business insurance, different types of products. But the savings product is a big growth area for them, that's kind of where a lot of that growth of loan book is coming from, is from the increases to saving. And the other thing I'd quickly say is that there is a disproportionate amount with that 1.5 to 2% overdue. When you actually take the four worst countries where that exists, that accounts for like 10% of their loan book. So I mean, the amount is absolutely minuscule when you actually look at it. And the strong markets that are growing at, some of them are growing at 50 to 100% per year, I mean, it is just off the charts in terms of its growth potential.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, you know, the net interest margin of 39% is partly a reflection of this inflation rate, because it's obviously done in nominal terms. But let's just assume if you had an underlying inflation rate of, say, 10%, 15% for your whole, you know, the portfolio, okay, that still gives you 25 to 30% net interest margin. Another 10%, you know, sort of like bad debts, okay, that will take you down to 15 to 20%. I mean, you still have a net interest margin, which would be the, you know, absolutely huge compared to NatWest on 2 or 3. So,
yeah. I mean, the only thing I'd say, though, is that that 10% bad debt just isn't there. I mean, you'd expect it.
Yeah, but the point I was saying was that that's a margin of error, isn't it? I mean, it's just sort of like enormous.
Oh, gosh, yes.
margin of safety anyway. Okay, let's go for the last one in this sort of emerging markets. So we've got oil and gas services company Gulf Marine come out with a lot of contract wins of late.
Yes.
Of late, these guys do these effectively drill rigs that help and support just sort of drilling largely in the Middle East, but also do a bit of the same sort of thing in the North Sea with the renewables, etc. How do you see this one? The shares have done pretty well actually since early December.
Yeah. Look, I mean, last year I didn't like it very much. I'll admit, I kind of looked at it and sort of said, you know, like their investor relations material is very poor and it's got errors in it, and you know, was a bit sort of lukewarm towards it. I think I wrote an article, "Where are the nuclear vessels?" or something like that, and it was down to like, show me the answers, because like you're just not very clear with it all. But anyway, I kind of warmed up to it after a while. I do like the fact that the day rates basically the reason I kind of particularly came to like it. And when you actually look, I mean, a great example of their poor reporting, they gave 9-month results, they gave 6-month results, but you've actually got to kind of work out the number of what I call the vessel days, number of vessels, number of days, and the utilization percentage to work out what the day rate actually was in the third quarter. And the answer is that when you actually do the maths, that the day rate rose by about $750 from 36,000 a day to 36,750. Why not just tell investors that? Why should that be like state secrets? But anyway, that's my soapbox thing. But yeah, look, I mean, you're paying like essentially like 3x EBITDA earnings. It's deleveraging fast. They are buying another vessel. I mean, I think the demand for oil services is extremely high from what I've seen, especially in the Gulf States. There's and shallow offshore, it's extremely robust, and they're in a very sweet spot essentially. That, yeah, absolutely reflected in the fact that their backlog now, or their order book, is I think I'm right in saying 0.7 billion, whereas last year when I was looking at it, it was sort of at about 300-350 million. So it's doubled. And I think the other thing I would also say, the other just quick macro, is that as well as drill ships or sort of supporting drilling programs, these vessels can also be used for offshore wind. And again, offshore wind in the North Sea is just colossal.
Yeah. Just on those day rates, I mean, obviously it's the average day rates for crude three. How is that growth rate in the day rates going by quarter? You said it was 7% in Q3. Yeah. And then likewise, what's your thoughts on the new contract day rates? Because you find with these historical things, because you add to your order book, and it only takes time before the official final overall day rates comes down. It's like the employment situation. You have to look at the marginal change. So about the day rates? What are your thoughts on the day rates of the existing contract, new contracts they've just signed, and the growth rate of the day rates? What's that happening?
Well, unfortunately, the disclosures aren't really there to be able to.
Okay.
I mean, once the full year results are out, I think we'll have a better picture. But yeah, look, I mean, I'm pretty comfortable that they are going to be robust, that they are going to be heading in the right direction. And the other quick one actually is, go and look at note 5 of their accounts, and they've got a recoverable amount. So it's a bit like Avation, that the net realizable value of their vessels is something like 80 million higher than what their book value is. So essentially, when you factor that in, I mean, you're buying the whole thing at about a 25% discount to NAV as well. I mean, it like every which way you paint it, it's just got a lot going for it. And it's great. As far as I'm concerned, a great share to own.
Okay, good. Let's turn seconds. Let's go to the UK. We've got food on the go retailer Greggs, king of the sausage roll. Unfortunately, though, the shares have been a bit burnt of late, and they're actually down about half, actually, looking over just about the last year. How do you see this one panning out?
Well, this one is the most shorted. I think I'm right in saying it's the most shorted stock in the UK. So 13. Disclosable shorts, 13% of its stock is shorted. And 13% is going to be unlucky for somebody. And I don't think it's going to be the Gregorians, which is what I call the GRG shareholders. I think the... I mean, Greggs is a great cultural brand. I mean, you go on like TikTok, not that I go on TikTok, but you go on TikTok and the like, and everyone's babbling on about, I've got my Greggs in for the week. And I walk past a Greggs and there's a queue, like every time. And I was at a coach station, I was at Victoria coach station, waiting for a coach for several hours. There's a Greggs in there. And all I did was sat and watched the queue. And the queue was just there for several hours, so look, I think this whole thesis of Greggs is in trouble and all the rest of it is just nonsense, absolute nonsense. I would say when you look at the investment they've made into their business, even netting off depreciation, they have invested a net 500 million, half a billion, into their business since 2021. Their return on capital employed is 20%. If you go back in their accounts, it's 20%. So that 500 million, they're anticipating that they're going to grow their profits by 100 million is my thesis. And the way that they currently pick stock to go to their thousands of stores is they do that manually. They're literally like, oh, there's two chicken sandwiches for this shop and three ham sandwiches for that shop. Automating all of that is going to save, I mean, especially with National Living Wage and Employers NI, it's going to save like a huge amount of money. So that's a big part of it as well. I think as well, the actual results themselves, I mean, my thesis is that we're going to see a 265 million operating profit in 2025. Now, we know what the first half was. It was 70 million. We don't know what the second half was, but here's my theory. Cash increased. So we know investment was 150 million. We know cash increased by 15 million. We also know that new shops were open. So working capital will have grown. Put all of that together, and you've got to have something like 200 million of operating cash flow to support that, hence 265 million. And they've also said that their 2026 results might only be as good as their 2025 results. I'm pretty happy with 265 million operating profit. I think that it's sold off with absolutely no logic whatsoever. I think it's and we could talk about saturation as well, but I just think it's mispriced.
Yeah, just on that saturation, because that's the main reason, is that you obviously raise a good point in terms they can take out a lot of the cost with automation. But the market and its investors, it used to be a growth darling. And it's like for like, I think, a flat, a sort of one or two. It's inflation at most in terms of their, being able to increase their sales. So how are they going to sort of like sort that out with peak sausage roll and peak saturation?
Yeah, well, depends when they're buying the sausage roll. I mean, they've got a good chunk of the breakfast market. I actually did some maths where I went through what's the size of the food to go market, what's the size of the breakfast market, the lunch market, the dinner market. They've got vast amounts of growth potential in the evening market. I would also argue that there's parts of the country that are underserved by Greggs, that when you actually look at the pro rata, that there's you would be able to squeeze in 3,000 Greggs, and there's a growth macro there of right, several years at least, plus then the evening market. But then you've got Republic of Ireland, you've got places like Spain. Now, Greggs once upon a time expanded into Belgium, and I don't want to cast aspersions on Belgians, but their national dishes are like mussels and garlic. you know, maybe it wasn't the right place for sausage rolls and pasties that the Belgians didn't appreciate. But I know that the Spanish love pasties and sausage rolls. And like, I know that because I know people that own food places in Spain that are, you know, British. And as much as they serve the expat community, they say to me, at least as many Spanish come in and buy our sausage rolls.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're definitely. I mean, from my personal experience, they're the best sausage roll maker in the country by a mile. In fact, I've even tried it on the frozen ones where you buy them from Tesco's and then you put them in your oven and cook them. And they're even better than the ones in the store. So if anybody wants to have a tip on sausage rolls, that's definitely worth doing.
Definitely.
Okay, let's.
And funny
let's
you
move
should to... mention Tesco's because I mean that is another part of the investment thesis. So they've been selling into Iceland for years. They're now in, I mean, within like just the past few months, they're now in one third of the Tesco stores, 900 Tesco stores. There's a lot further to go with that macro as well. And just selling frozen food. I mean, like, you know, like move over Bird's Eye, here comes Greg's.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, no, it's definitely good. Okay, let's go to one of the airlines, low cost. We've got EasyJet, like all this sector with a jet too. They're all very cheap, actually. IAG, sort of 6-7 times PEs, I think, actually, on this one. What's your sort of, again, your investment thesis on EasyJet? The old Stelios sort of like airline, isn't it?
Yeah. The orange, yes. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you could buy it today. I've bought some more today. I went shopping this morning with EasyJet going on sale. So look, I mean, you can buy it at a 7% discount to its NAV today, 3.3 billion market cap. The NAV, 3.5, I mean, that's made up of aircraft, the value of 4.7 billion. But when you look at those aircraft, I mean, you've got, like 40% of those are the newer Neo aircraft. Anyway, in my estimation, the average price of those aircraft, well, they've got them on the books at 30 million each. I mean, if we were talking A319s, then yes, I could see how 205 A319s could be worth about 30 million. Bear in mind, Avation recently got compensation for one of their A320s, and they got $33 million. So you know, the going rate for these aircraft is far higher than so my estimation is that the book value of EasyJet is $7 billion. So it's kind of, you know, there's about 50% upside just if you just post it down and sold off the assets. But it's holidays business is where the, for me, the excitement is. Now, everyone knows Jet2, amazing holidays, da-di-da, hold my hand, all of that. The CSAT scores with Jet2 is 84.3. The CSAT scores for EasyJet holidays is 83. It's 1.3% difference between them. And I just think EasyJet has, I mean, if Jet2 want to offer a new holiday to Timbuktu, they've got to buy an aircraft to go and fly to Timbuktu. And I don't mean literally Timbuktu, but I mean, let's say Malaga. Jet2 have to get an aircraft and, you know, or series of aircraft and then sort of charter them or send them to Malaga. EasyJet already flies to Malaga. No problem. We'll just sell some of our seats to holidaymakers, to EasyJet Holidays, rather than EasyJet Travel. So, you know, the expansion capability of EasyJet is far higher, and they make £4 a seat. Done all the maths. £4 a seat selling tickets to travellers, you know, people that go on a EasyJet plane. But if they sell them a holiday, the profit triples or quadruples, because the profit on each holiday is about £12. The other macro behind this is that they are replacing, they're spending $8 billion over the next couple of years on more Neo aircraft. The profitability of a Neo aircraft is plus £10. Well, for the smaller Neo, the 320 Neo is plus £10 a seat, and then the larger 321 Neo plus £16 a seat. Again, you know, the profit over doubles, triples, just because the cost of serving that customer goes down by a vast amount as well. So yeah, look, I just think it's fundamentally mispriced. It's the negative is obviously today's news, or at least the ongoing conflict, and the also the fact that EasyJet has just dropped out of the FTSE 100. So there's a couple of opportunities to potentially pick this up even cheaper, but I think its current price, I think it's 440 this morning, it's well cheap.
What sort of like timescales do they hedge forward their oil, their kerosene, their, you know, basically jet fuel? Because obviously, if the cost of travel goes up, and they've got to take it, then they've sold the tickets. They're in it. But what's sort of like that? What's the forward cover on there?
Yeah, they definitely do have forward. From memory, I think it's something like 2 years ahead, something like that. Right, and okay. and not necessarily 100% coverage either. But yeah, they'll have substantial coverage. I mean, everyone does.
Okay, good. Let's finish off some questions. We had Josh pre-asking us the question about Future Group. It's a price comparison website that is a bit of a Marmite stock. It also has a lot of sort of tech magazines and websites that it sells advertising on. The shares have been absolutely annihilated. He's basically saying, is this a value play or this is a value trap? The shares trade, he was saying, at about 4x. Price earnings, which means there's a lot of bad news already priced in. But how do you see it?
Well, look, I could see this company own like 170, I think it's 175 brands, and some of those brands, I mean, I grew up with Total Film, you know, that magazine is now no more, and that's a Future magazine. So Future are killing off brands and magazines, you know, publications that aren't working for them, and they're not shy in doing so. So I think more brands could or will go. I think there's a distinction you should draw between the brands or the magazines, publication is probably the right word, isn't it? The publications that I would describe as functional. So I buy PC something or other magazine. They've probably got, I mean, I think Tech Radar is one of their publications. So I might buy Tech Radar because I'm thinking of buying a laptop, and I go on there and I sort of, you know, can see what they reckon is the best laptop. In the future, I might use AI to do that buying for me, you know, agentic AI or something could replace and disrupt. So I kind of get why some of its brands could be toast. I wonder about GoCompare as well, because I know GoCompare is a big part of Future, that could be disrupted. I don't think anytime soon. I think that, especially as they've got a renewal app, they literally call it the renewal app. I think that is actually probably quite sticky. I mean, somebody said this the other day about Trainline. It's muscle memory to just go and buy another ticket. And it's probably muscle memory to go and rebuy your insurance in the same way. And I think that the point about sort of disruption is that, I mean, they can just, you know, GoCompare can just rebrand itself as an agentic AI as well. I mean, at the end of the day, it's an intermediary that is working on your behalf to find you the best deal. So I think Future is mispriced. I don't own it. I've looked at it and I'm sort of pondering it. I think I would draw people's attention to their little virtuous circle where they have just got it on screen here, that they've got their the circle of audience and engagement. I mean, look, Here's a good way of valuing Future. I think you can buy it for about 385 million, and then you've got sort of 567 digital sessions. And I did some research on this that told me that everyone sort of goes on there twice. So that you're talking about 300 million, maybe about 300 million audience, and then they've got 3 million magazine, you know, physical off what they call the offline audience. So 303 million. Like, so 385 million to get 303 million audience, it's like £1.30 per audience member. What's the value of that audience member? I mean, it's like, it's like with like Vox Markets, you guys have got 12,500 subscribers. If I offered you £1.30 times 12.5 is 18,000 or 19,000, you'd probably tell me to go fourth and something. You know, your brand and audience and engagement is worth far more. You know, and I think that's the thing I would look at this as, is that
good point.
Especially things like Marie Claire. I mean, like, it's the place to be seen and, you know, the magazine to be seen with. It's like, I just don't get how AI will disrupt what is a cultural thing and an audience and an engagement thing. That's my view on it.
No, you raise a good point. I mean, I must admit, I'm a bit more cautious. I sort of look at it, the delta of competitive positioning or advantage. And if a company's losing its competitive moat to new operators or existing operators, I'm sort of quite nervous because I think the E is under pressure going forward. But a lot of very bad, that's already in the share price. And at 4x PE, a lot of bad news is already in it. But you raise a good point. If somebody wanted to buy it and they want to buy all those 380 million users, then what price would they pay? So that could go for us, you know, some of the parts. But interesting one. Okay, good. I don't know whether you own it or you got any sort of views on it. We've got Andy's asking about MSI International, which is a defense. Well, basically, it's got three divisions. It's got an engineering division, but it's real sort of like modus operandi. It's this defense business that does sort of like a sighting and gunning type turrets, which go on to naval ships and stuff like that. Obviously, very topical at the moment. Yeah, any quick thoughts on any quick thoughts on MSI at all?
I mean, it looks a good company. It's not one I know very much on, other than to say, I mean, obviously, yes, it's topical. The only thing I'd caution Andy on there is whether, it, you know, like that is already in the price. And, it, you know, if you're buying it at what you consider a good price relative to its potential, and whether that will remain. You know, so, yeah, look, I mean, you can see there it's on a pullback. So it could be a good opportunity. I think that's one I'll maybe have a look at myself.
Okay, good. What about we've got who was it, Lewis, asking about Atomi Energy, which is basically, I think it's a hydrogen, green hydrogen. Have you ever had a look at that at all? Okay. No.
A little bit. I mean, they got spun off from President Energy, and yeah, I mean, they're doing some interesting things down in South America, and I must say, it looks an interesting stock. I don't have a strong view on it, and I mean, again, it's one that I in fact, one of my readers said to, it might actually be Lewis, I don't know, but you know, somebody did say, oh, you should look at Atomi I don't know how you pronounce it.
Atom,
okay, I think it potentially is a you know, certainly worth further research.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm not really familiar with it. And the last one, he's got Squids. He's asking about Kazera Global. That's K-A-Z-E-R-A. I don't even have a clue what the thing is. I've never even heard of it.
Ticker, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, look, Kazera, again, you would have made a lot of money on Kazera. So it's done well. These guys are on the cusp of getting their 34 times larger beach. Now, these guys mine heavy mineral sands, and in those heavy mineral sands are prolifically large diamonds. Now, there's a couple of negatives. I mean, they are sort of in the back of beyond. They're on the sort of edge of Namibia, the far north of South Africa, and the nearest port is hundreds of miles. I've actually covered this in an article where I've said, well, you know, the key here is to get the concentration of the heavy mineral sands to a really good level, and then to, and they're doing all of that. They're putting some further investment in. I think the diamonds do look particularly interesting, and the what was described as the likely rates, I think from memory it was 400 a carat. I mean, look, if Kazera are going to get 400 a carat and they're pulling out, you know, things that are 6 carats and larger, I mean, they're going to be making money. I hold Kazera. I think Kazera's got a lot further to go. And when they get the 34 times larger beach, which has got held up, I mean, things in South Africa just do take a lot of time. I mean, you've just got to have patience. But I do think it's got further to go. And when they get the 34 times beach, the Purdevli beach, I think it's just going to go pop, absolutely explode upwards. So, yeah, look, I'm positive on it.
Okay, yeah, because I mean, the big thing about diamonds, or the big competitor, is lab diamonds, isn't it? And my youngest daughter got married before Christmas, and they looked at diamonds and then thought, nah, it's a damn sight cheaper. Let's go for lab diamonds.
Well, it takes 100 kilowatts to make a carat of lab diamonds, and there is a cost to those. So there is a sort of a baseline, I mean, the other thing that Kazera has is its lithium, or you know, its debt from Hebe that may or may not be collected, and they may just take possession back of the tantalum and lithium mine that they have. That I mean, with lithium got lithium up about 150%, and tantalum remains at something like 240,000 a ton. I mean, it's that as well is just further upside potentially.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thanks very much, John. Thanks everyone for your questions. Before we finish, though, what we ask all my experts what their sort of favorite stock idea is for the next sort of like 12 to 18 months. Anything which would sort of like you would highlight?
Well, I mean, one that I quickly mention. So IIG in Intuitive Investments. So this is a play on the digitization of the Chinese lottery. 20 times more people in China than the UK. They currently have 200,000 lottery shops that do paper tickets, and there's something like $40 billion spent on paper tickets. With digital tickets, if you read across even to like the UK National Lottery, bearing in mind that no other forms of gambling are allowed in China, and I think this one has upside of, well, potential upside of 1,000% or far, far more. They've also got deals with Sinopec, 28,000 petrol stations, which is 3 times the number of petrol stations in all of the UK. They've also got a deal with Diageo, who sell Baijiu, which is a Chinese liquor. So they're putting a lottery ticket on every bottle of Baijiu because there's so much what do they call it? Bootlegged liquor that gets sold in China. 25% of all liquor is basically contraband, is like moonshine, and so selling a lottery ticket is like a surefire way of proving that what you're buying is actually, you know, sort of proper stuff. They've also got something like something like a 1.4% profit margin, which when you extrapolate the numbers, I mean, I've got an article on it on my Substack that it's the upside potential. I mean, I'd say that's probably the one that I would just end on. It's just very exciting potential, but a moonshot, you know.
Yeah. Can you trust the numbers? Because that was the thing about when they did a whole lot, Chinese companies 15, 20 years ago, they had a lot of IPOs, and then everybody realized all the numbers didn't exist.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, look, there's two lotteries today, 40, you know, and the numbers are real, as in, you know, we can know how many tickets were bought. So there's the sport lottery, which is kind of like the equivalent of like the British Olympic Committee. It's like the Chinese Olympic Committee. And then they've got like a humanitarian one that pays for like care homes and, you know, old people's homes. So there's that, they call it the health lottery. So those are real, and those are you know, the problem with the paper tickets is that you've physically got to go to one of these 200,000, and 200,000 shops sounds a lot, but in a place the size of China, that's like sort of, you know, it's like completely antiquated. And so if you've got an app on your phone where you can sort of do the lottery, I mean, you know, in the UK when they introduced the national lottery, I mean, it was introduced into, as I say, into lots of outlets and shops, and the merchandising side of this as well. They've got a deal with the Olympic Committee of China to sell all the Chinese you know, like pandas and, you know, all of the. So again, you know, when you sort of do the equivalent of, like, so the British Olympic Committee have got a deal with, I think it's Tommy Hilfiger, you know, and one other I mean, that is potentially worth, you know, the merchandise side of it is worth a colossal amount as well. As I say, a deal with Diageo as well. So yeah, potential. When you look at sort of comparative read across markets as well, like Taiwan or Thailand, or, you know, sort of Asian countries. I mean, compared to Britain, where we've got lots of forms of gambling, horse racing, you know, whatever, that they've only got the lottery, and the participation rates in most other Asian countries is sort of more towards about 50%. And if that's true, then it's not just 1,000% upside. It's potentially far more. So I think the potential and the numbers, people like to do, you know, people like to have a little flutter.
No, they do. Well, certainly the Chinese do. I mean, look at Macau. I mean, it's absolutely blitzing, isn't it? You know, in there. But what one thing to say about China, do you know who the
auditor is at all, and whether they're given, because the big question for Western companies was sort of like, yeah, they'd appoint sort of Deloitte globally, and then you wouldn't, the Deloitte partner in the UK couldn't go and visit and audit the Chinese Deloitte because it was a local partner, and they wouldn't allow them to review the document. So I think that's one thing just for investors, is just have a look at making sure that those numbers
due diligence
are, just to see whether there's independence, because that was one of the reasons why a lot of the US sort of legal, you know, sort of like they've stopped a lot of Chinese companies IPOing in the US because they can't get access of their auditors into China to actually sign the things off.
But I mean, IIG themselves, I mean, they own the company that itself is based in China, and it's a 300 million market cap. So we're not talking about some little pipe dream. I mean, and they've built all the technology. I mean, that 300 million. Yeah, okay. Has been to build out the infrastructure and to get the sign off with the regulator. So it's the Chinese regulator that has actually signed this off. So it's just now a land and expand. So it's whether that can happen and will happen. And as you say, you know, the due diligence behind that. But I've looked at it and I'm pretty comfortable.
Okay, fantastic. That's a lovely way to finish. Thanks, John. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. Apologies for my sort of technical problems right at the start, but John carried on fantastically, so that was good. So hopefully we'll touch base in about sort of 6 months' time. So keep investing, guys.
Cheers, everyone. Have a good day.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.